This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're spending the hour with reporters to find out what's been happening at the Indiana State House during the ongoing legislative session. We're joined now by Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Before we dig into specific bills, can you give us a bit of a broad overview on how the session has been going so far and what lawmakers seem to be most focused on?
Sure. Well, importantly, this is a non-budget session, which means it's a short session. So the session only goes from the start of January through early to mid-March. And what that means, what it used to mean a long time ago, was that lawmakers would simply do fewer things. In fact, these off-year sessions, as they're sometimes referred to, weren't even a thing years and years and years ago. Then they were created as emergency sessions, only for emergencies. And eventually lawmakers started meeting every single year to do little things here and there. But lawmakers are trying to do a whole lot of big things this year. They just have less time than usual to do them because it's a short session. So, you know, committee hearings are packed every single week. It's often called a sprint to the finish line. They've been working at a breakneck pace. So that's an important thing to remember about this particular legislative session. And in general, there are a few big topics that we'll talk about here and that lawmakers are focused on, things like vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine mandates, tax cuts, school curriculum, things like that, that I know you'll talk with Jeannie Lindsay about and things like that. So, they're not shying away from a lot of big controversial topics, despite the fact that I don't have a lot of time to do them.
Is that unusual for a session like this, or has this become the norm?
A little bit of both. It's not entirely unusual. I've been reporting here at the State House for over a decade now. This is my 12th session covering the General Assembly. They have never shied away from trying to take on a lot in a short session. It does feel this session, though, that they are tackling bigger and more controversial subjects than they sometimes do during a short session, in particular because the short session also coincides with it being an election year. And so a lot of times we've seen lawmakers kind of try and shy away from the more politically hot topics, if you will, because they know they have to face the voters in a few months. But clearly, and perhaps even because of that, in fact, they are not taking the same route this year.
Has there been anything that completely surprised you this session that might have been unexpected, come out of nowhere?
I think the pace at which particularly the House was working. Lawmakers, much like journalists, love to procrastinate. They will take their time as often as possible and work as close to their deadlines as possible a lot of times. The House certainly did not do that this year. They started off as fast as possible. They've been throwing a lot of these really big controversial measures right away. They are not wasting any time. So I think that's been a little bit unusual this session compared to all the other sessions that I've covered. Is there was no hanging around, taking their time on any of this. They are going right at it.
With us being 2 years into the pandemic now, are there some things that you've noticed with regards to how the pandemic has impacted lawmakers and the legislative session?
Not particularly this session. So last year, we saw several changes because of the pandemic. The House moved its entire chamber over to a different government building in order to accommodate greater social distancing. There was mask wearing a little more frequently last session. There were a lot of plastic barriers that were erected on the floors of the chambers. There were in committees. In the Senate, for instance, last session, they separated Senate lawmakers from the people who were testifying into two separate rooms so that the rooms weren't crowded and things like that. They limited the number of people in those rooms. All of that, every single COVID sort of safety protocol has been completely abandoned this year by the legislature. Mask wearing is a big one. Republicans generally do not wear masks. Democrats generally do. There are exceptions to both, but generally that's how we've seen it go this session. And I think one consequence of all of this is that, because certainly the pandemic is not over, COVID is still around. It's very much around. In fact, we're still in the middle of one of the worst surges of the entire pandemic right now because of the Omicron variant. We've seen a lot of lawmakers who are absent, and not enough that it's dramatically impacted business. But we are coming up to deadlines now when they have to pass bills out of their first chamber by a certain time. And if a bunch of lawmakers get sick, or more importantly, sometimes if staff gets sick, that's going to create a real problem. We didn't really have any outbreaks last year, to their credit. in part because of all those protocols I've talked about. This year, all those protocols are gone. We haven't seen any huge outbreaks, or at least not noticeable, because they won't tell us if lawmakers are out, or how many lawmakers, how many staff have the virus. But it certainly has a greater chance of happening.
That's interesting that everything has been done away with COVID precautions. I know we'll talk a little bit more about some of the COVID mandate debates, but I am curious, there's no tracking system in place, like in some, I don't know, some schools and places. I know there's talk of getting rid of contact tracing in some instances, but with regards to state government, there's no tracking to see who's got COVID or who's been around who?
Not in the legislature in any formal way that we've seen. I mean, it's possible that legislative leadership are keeping track of staff and members who have the virus and have to be out or quarantining, but they certainly aren't telling anybody about it. So,
well, I do want to get into some bills. You recently reported on a bill that involves small nuclear reactors. Can you tell us a bit more about this bill and what would it do if it passes?
Sure. That was a story written by our great environmental reporter, Rebecca Thiel, for Indiana Public Broadcasting. So it's this interesting idea of, Indiana has a state that historically has been incredibly reliant on coal for its energy production. It still is in a lot of ways, but that is starting to change. And so this is an effort to find another source. So there's been these sort of things that are shopped around, if you will, that are smaller, more advanced nuclear power plants. Indiana does not have a nuclear power plant, never has. But these would be smaller and more advanced than the sort of power plants we've seen elsewhere around the country. The problem is that they really aren't very well tested. So there's some in the nuclear, some scientists who believe that the smaller size is often used or sometimes used to justify cutting back on safety equipment and shrinking the area that would evacuate in a disaster. There's also a question of, we just don't know enough about these to start doing them. Now, if this bill becomes law, it's not like we're going to see one of these plants pop up tomorrow, because there's also still the question about how do we store nuclear waste, which is not really a question that we've answered in this country. So it has its, it certainly has its detractors who are worried about long-term impact and sort of the unanswered questions. But it also, you can see the appeal, which is that some believe this is safer and certainly better for the environment than traditional coal-fired plants. And it does provide a more reliable source of energy as we perhaps start to worry about that going into the future. But I'm not sure whether that bill will pass, because it's one of those where on both sides of the aisle, you'll have folks who like it and folks who don't.
Do energy bills in general, aren't they pretty complicated at the State House? I'm just thinking about, I know there's a lot with solar energy that we've talked about on this show before. It seems like there's a lot of hurdles.
There are, particularly for renewable energy, because quite frankly, utility companies have play a significant role at the State House in terms of their influence on the Republican supermajorities and the Republican-controlled legislature. Quite frankly, energy issues often are energy bills coming out of the State House are often passed over the objections of environmental advocates, climate change advocates, scientists, that sort of thing, at the behest of utility companies.
When it comes to anti-abortion bills that we've seen at the State House, is there anything that's come up this session that is different or more of the same?
A big difference in that we aren't seeing any major anti-abortion bills. I've covered, like I said, for 12 sessions, and I can count on less than one hand the number of sessions we've seen that they haven't done a major anti-abortion bill. But they are avoiding that. There's going to be one, maybe two, that will sort of, deal with things at the fringes of abortion laws. Nothing really, really significant in those areas. And that's for a very specific reason. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected later this year to make a landmark ruling on abortion rights. A lot of people think they will eliminate or severely curtail abortion rights, the right to legal access to a safe abortion. Lawmakers here think that's the case, too. But we don't know exactly what the court will say. They could go a few different routes. They could overturn Roe v. Wade, their landmark abortion rights ruling from 1973. They could overturn that entirely and say, you know, states can now basically ban all abortions. If that's the case, Indiana will do that. They could also, one of the lawsuits they're dealing with is out of the state of Mississippi, which restricted abortions until up until 15 weeks of pregnancy. That is the greatest restriction. The court has never allowed a restriction that tight before. So if they just said the Mississippi law is okay, Indiana lawmakers would immediately come in and pass a bill that would say, okay, after 15 weeks, abortions are banned. Anything they can do to restrict abortion, Indiana lawmakers will do. But because they don't know exactly what the Supreme Court will say, what they're going to do is they're going to wait. And they're going to say, okay, let's see what the court rules. And then if it is significant, they will ask the governor to call a special session of the General Assembly sometime probably this summer and come in and just do whatever anti-abortion bill they can get away with.
So they're just waiting to see how it plays out on the national level first.
Yeah, they and a lot of other people.
When it comes to cultural issues, how have those played a role in the session, this session?
I kind of alluded to this earlier. A lot of times we'll see on some of those issues, lawmakers want to avoid that in a short session because they've got elections coming up. But the reverse is actually true this year. We have heard that several House Republicans are worried about primaries. The redistricting and things like that have meant that there are very few general election races at the State House that are contentious anymore. Or competitive, I should say. And so what lawmakers really have to worry about are primaries. And when you worry about a primary, you're worrying about it from the more extreme factions of your party, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. So if you're a Republican in the majority, you're worried about a challenge from somebody further right than you. And so they are tackling, I think, more wholeheartedly some of these cultural, you know, social hot button issues this year than usual, in part because what we've heard is some of them are worried about primary challenges and want to make sure that they have something on the record as soon as possible saying, well, I stood up for X, Y, or Z at the State House.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're catching up on the ongoing legislative session in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today, we're talking about what's happening at the Indiana State House as we reach the halfway point in the ongoing legislative session. To help us out, we're joined again by Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon, I want to talk about the bill on construction zone speed cameras. Can you give us some insight into what that's about?
Yeah, this is another go-round for lawmakers. And this one is one of those, for me, a fun one because it crosses sort of the political boundaries. It's not necessarily a Republican versus Democrat issue. So it's very simple. Lawmakers have been trying for years now to create a pilot program that would allow the state to put speed cameras in highway construction zones. It wouldn't be every construction zone necessarily, but it would allow them to put speed cameras in highway construction zones. So when workers are there, if you're speeding through that zone, the camera takes a picture of your license plate. And if you're going at least 11 miles per hour over the speed limit, you can be given a ticket without a cop pulling you over. The idea is to slow down speeders. And there is evidence from around the country that have programs like this, that it does work to reduce speeding in those zones because there are signs up that say, hey, there could be a camera watching you and all that. But you have folks on both sides of the aisle who don't like this bill because of the privacy concerns and don't like the idea of a camera and not a human being issuing citations. And so it's never quite gotten past those sort of hurdles. There are also some questions about, we've seen one lawmaker, Senator Chris Garton, he represents a district on the Ohio River, and that those bridges over the Ohio River have photo traffic enforcement. And he said, you know, he's had constituents come to him and say, hey, I went over this bridge. Apparently they issued me a citation, but I never got any communication. I never got anything in the mail. And all of a sudden, when I went to go renew my license at the BMV, it said my license was suspended because I didn't pay this fine. So there are questions about sort of administration, too. Like I said, they've been trying for years to do something like this. They're trying again this year. I don't know what, if any, the magic formula is to get this bill passed. It might never. But they'll certainly keep trying.
Are they looking to any other states or places where they have these efforts already underway?
Sure. They've looked at other states where these sorts of things are in place. Off the top of my head, I think Maryland was one, a popular one. There's also looking at other states that have not done it well. I think Pennsylvania is one of those examples, but don't hold me to that. So, they always look at how other states are doing it. But again, it's the greater concerns are about privacy and administration. And again, I'm not sure they'll ever be able to overcome that hurdle.
You've reported on the Indiana House approving a tax cut package that will eventually cost the state $1 billion a year in revenue. Can you give us a little insight into that?
Sure. That's one of the major bills of this session. So as you said, it'll cost the state about $1 billion a year eventually. So these tax cuts, it's a variety of tax cuts. There are business tax cuts. They would eliminate a couple fees that when you pay your utility bill, you see on your bill as coming from the state. That would eliminate those. And then it would cut the state's individual income tax from 3.23%, which is what it is now, step by step over on the next few years down to 3% eventually. And so when all of these tax cuts and eliminations take effect, which again would take a few years, eventually the state was projected to take in at least and often more than $1 billion less a year than they're taking in right now.
Is this something that was expected for them to work on?
Yeah, we expected a tax cut debate. House lawmakers made no secret of that. I think it was a little surprising just how big the tax cut was. I mean, more than $1 billion a year is a big price tag. I don't think we were quite expecting that, in part because there's not agreement among Republicans about this tax cut bill. House Republicans are all for it. It's already passed the Indiana House, as you said. But the Senate Republicans and the governor have both been saying, whoa, let's hit the brakes here for a second. It's not that they're opposed to tax cuts. They are Republicans. But what they're saying is this is a non-budget session. Why don't we wait until 2023, next year, when we write a new state budget, to have a more full discussion about what this will mean for state finances going forward? Senate Republicans are also saying, like, hey, we know that Indiana's finances have been great lately, and they have. We are seeing record levels of revenue and budget surpluses. But a lot of that is attributed to all of that federal economic stimulus money that came into the state. Now, it's not direct. It's not like they took that money and put it in the state's general funds. They aren't doing that. What they are doing is, spending a lot on things they otherwise wouldn't have been able to spend on. It's generating economic activity. We saw that with the amount of sales tax that Indiana took in throughout the pandemic. It was expected to crater, and initially it did, but then it kind of ticked back up because people were spending that stimulus money that they got. So Indiana is flush with cash. There's no doubt about that. But what Senate Republicans are saying is, well, we don't really know how flush with cash we are because we're still feeling the effect of those stimulus funds. There's also things to worry about in the future. The inflationary pressure we're feeling, things like that could, supply chain issues, worker shortages that could affect our economy and the state's finances as a result. And we'll have a better picture of what that impact might be a year from now as opposed to right this second. And then the governor has been saying, hey, I want to spend some money in the next state budget. I want to spend money on improving our public health system. I want to spend money on another economic development program, the READY initiative that he created this past year. I want to spend money on paying state employees a much higher wage because they are, in a lot of cases, making not a lot of money, and that's hurting recruitment, that's hurting retention. I've talked to people who say they see full-time state employees in bankruptcy court. Because they just aren't making enough money. So both of those sort of concerns say, hey, maybe let's slow down and not pass quite so big a package. We'll see what they ultimately agree on. I would say expect a tax cut this session. How big that tax cut will be the real question.
Apologies. Once again, I forgot to turn my microphone back on. So who would be most impacted by these tax cuts? Is it clear now, or is it still kind of a mix of things?
Well, first and foremost, businesses. There are a host of business tax cuts. It would help the business community tremendously, pay less tax than they are currently paying, despite the fact that Indiana was recently by the Tax Foundation ranked the ninth best business tax climate in the country and by far the best in the Midwest. But individuals would see tax cuts. If you pay the income tax, your tax will go down. Although the estimate is, so let's say the median household income in Indiana is about $56,000 a year. And for someone making that or a household making that, by the time the income tax cut was fully effective, you'd see about $128 a year saving. That's not insignificant for some households, for sure, although it's less the less you make and it's more the more you make. And then those utility rates, those utility taxes that I mentioned also would likely be wiped off your bill. That's not a lot of money. That's probably like 10 bucks off your bill. But again, that can add up over time.
If you're listening live right now and have any questions or comments for the program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That number again is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon, the Indiana House voting to effectively block private companies is something you've reported on from enforcing COVID-19 mandates. What is currently underway at the State House surrounding vaccines?
Yeah, there's a lot of anger, quite frankly, among Republicans at the State House over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. A lot of that anger was directed at President Biden over his attempt to force any company with at least 100 employers to impose COVID-19 vaccine mandates. That obviously was ultimately unsuccessful. The Supreme Court recently ruled on that. But House Republicans, at least, are still pushing this idea that you shouldn't be allowed to be fired effectively just because you refuse to take the COVID-19 vaccine. And they have, you know, we've had a couple of hearings now where, you know, you had people come and say, hey, you know, I'm going to lose my job because I refuse to get this vaccine. Now, a lot of those were healthcare workers. And another thing the Supreme Court said was that the Biden administration's healthcare worker vaccine mandate rule can take effect. So a lot of those people who've testified in the General Assembly, a lot of the people that lawmakers have been talking about wouldn't be helped by this bill at all. But nevertheless, they still want to pass it. The House already did pass it. There's a question as to, though, how excited the Senate is, the Senate Republican caucus is, to pass this bill as well. The indication, at least at this point, is they are not as excited as the House Republicans were to do it, because there's the thought that, well, every healthcare organization in the state is opposing the bill, although the Republicans don't seem to care so much about that. What they do care about is that every major business group is opposed to it. Businesses basically are coming from the perspective of, we want to be able to do in our workplace what we need to do to keep our workers safe and leave us alone. And normally Republicans are pretty receptive to the leave us alone argument from businesses. But on this issue, they are not. At least the House Republicans weren't. So I'll be interested to see in the second half of session how excited Senate Republicans are to take up that cause.
Is this something that you would say is pretty bipartisan split with regards to these vaccine mandates?
Yes and no. I mean, obviously, in the House, at least, it was generally House Republicans who voted in favor of restricting what companies could do in regards to vaccine mandates, and Democrats voted against it. But again, like I said, as it goes over to the Senate, we'll see if there's the same reception to the idea from that Republican caucus as there was from the House Republican caucus.
You mentioned that businesses are opposed to some of these things. They want to be left alone. What kinds of other groups are you seeing that are trying to influence changes around these mandates?
Yeah, as I said, healthcare organizations, every major healthcare organization in the state is opposing this bill. They believe that vaccines are the best way to help get us out of this pandemic, and that anything that makes that harder is something to oppose. And so they're opposing this. In terms of the folks that are in favor of it, you've seen some sort of organized groups, but they're more grassroots level to them for the most part. It's you know, individual, you know, generally more like, you know, individual rights groups, libertarian ideas, that sort of thing, who are just like, you know, no person should ever have to be required to do anything medically speaking by their employer or by the government, although that argument never seems to extend to abortion for most of those folks. But that's mostly who you've seen involved in this effort here in Indiana.
There have been some bills you've been covering about guns and specifically licenses to carry guns. What are those trying to do?
Sure. And this is another one that's come up before and hasn't had success before now, although I think this year it looks like it has a really good chance. So this is a bill that once again came out of the Indiana House that would eliminate Indiana's license requirement to carry a handgun in public. So right now, generally speaking, if you're not on the list of people who aren't allowed to have a gun at all, so felons, and then there's a broader list than that, but felons is the big category. So me, for instance, I can go and buy a handgun right now. I go through a background check that says I can do that, hopefully. And I can carry that in my house. I can have that in my car, to and from places, you know, the shooting range, things like that. But in order to carry it in public, whether openly or concealed, I have to get a license from the state. And you go through, you apply with the state police. They do a quick check to make sure that you are not on the list of people who aren't allowed to carry in public. You have to go fingerprinting, and then you get your license. Lawmakers have already made that license free, so you don't have to pay for that license. That was a change they made last year. But now lawmakers are saying, and this is not uncommon. You've seen this in other states where pro-gun groups have pushed for what they call constitutional carry, which is that you shouldn't have to have a license to carry in public. The state police, the Indiana Chiefs of Police, the Indiana Prosecutors Association, the Fraternal Order of Police, they're all opposed to the bill because they say the license system is the only way for an officer in the field, let's say they pull over a car, they can check that system and say, does the person who's driving that car, do they have a license to carry? Should I, you know, if they have a gun, are they supposed to have that gun? And they say that's the best and safest way for officers in the field to know that information. And they don't want to get rid of the license system as a result. So there's been that push and pull for quite a few years, and it's never gotten to the finish line in large part because of that. However, this year, it's already passed the House. I suspect it will probably eventually pass the Senate. I stand to be wrong about that. We will see. That'll be one of the more interesting subplots we watch in the second half of session. But that's the crux of the bill.
Is there a reasoning why lawmakers are not paying attention to all of these different, law enforcement officials who are not in favor of this?
They care more about the sort of pro-gun Second Amendment argument than they do about what the police think.
Well, the Senate version of the gun bill seems to make changes that both pro and anti-gun groups would support. Is that causing any problems getting support from either side?
Yeah, nobody seems to be in favor of the bill as a result. But that's not quite true. There are some folks in favor of it. But I'll be honest with you, I don't think that Senate version of the bill will survive because of those issues you just talked about. There's some indication it might have even been a mistake in the way the bill was written, but it is the way the bill is currently written. So because that House bill already passed, they're already going to have to consider it, at least in the Senate side. There's a thought that that Senate version of the bill will probably just be put away into a drawer and they'll just deal with the House, the straight up or down like debate over should we require a license, should we not?
Well, before we wrap up here, I'm curious to know what you're covering and what's coming up next in the session that you can give us a sneak peek into.
I mean, that's a lot of the stuff we've already covered. You'll be talking with other reporters about some of the issues that they're watching, that I'm always watching, too, because it's interesting. But I think the biggest, and I've hit this, if you've been, you know, noticing several times, which is House bills that do make these huge sweeping changes or controversial issues, tackling these controversial issues, and the Senate seemingly harder to read, at the very least, if not outrightly not as supportive. And I think that's going to be one of the more fascinating things that to watch the rest of the session, is not just one issue or one bill, but on a host of issues. The House is just passing all of these bills, and I don't know what's going to survive the Indiana Senate. Maybe all of them do. Maybe none of them do. It's probably somewhere in between. But that's sort of a reversal from what we've seen the last few sessions. A lot of times it's the Senate who've been passing sort of more controversial or hot button issues and sending them over to the House, which quietly puts them away in one way, shape, or form. And this year, it's very reversed. As I said, a lot of people think that potential concerns about Republican primaries is playing a role there. Historically, the Senate, for one reason or another, is not as concerned about primary challenges as the House is, in part because every House lawmaker has to stand for election every 2 years, whereas Senate lawmakers have 4-year terms. But just in general, they've never seemed to be as worried about primaries for the most part. So that could be at play here. But it's a fascinating, I think, wrinkle to watch.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Brandon Smith is the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll be back after a quick break with two more reporters to talk about legislation around education and a package of crime bills at the State House. If you have any questions or comments, reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're catching up on what's been happening at the Indiana State House during the legislative session and what might be coming next. To learn more about a package of crime bills, we're joined now by Katrina Prost, criminal justice reporter for WFYI. Katrina, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You've been covering a package of bills moving through the State House that aim to reduce violent crime. Can you explain what's in this package and how many bills we're talking about?
Yeah, so this is a package of 5 bills that were announced in December by a group of Senate Republicans from Marion County. They all sit on the Senate Committee on Corrections and Criminal Law. So again, there's 5 bills. They target a couple areas in terms of reducing violent crime, including bail for violent arrestees, and a couple ways that they hope to, you know, reduce crime in Indianapolis and Marion County.
What arguments have been given for these bills to pass?
Yeah, so 2021 was another record-breaking year for homicides in Indianapolis. This is just kind of a hot topic right now that's being talked a lot about by politicians and different community leaders. And so one of the main issues is bail, and trying to, basically a lot of it came around an organization called the Bail Project. And there were, which basically is a nonprofit bail organization that aims to help low-income people pay their bail. And some people that had been, their bail had been paid for by this group went on to commit other violent crimes, allegedly. So that just kind of spurred a lot of conversation, particularly around the bail issue.
And are there specific problems these bills are trying to solve, aside from what you've mentioned?
That's the main one, as far as bail. And then there's, 2 other bills that aim to, they're like pilot programs for, in Indianapolis and Marion County to reduce violent crime, like having, you know, multiple police jurisdictions kind of working together, you know, from IMPD to IU police and like, other jurisdictions and Indiana State Police as well, to have them kind of all work together to, you know, prevent violent crime.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Katrina Prost, criminal justice reporter for WFYI. And if you have any questions or comments, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. Katrina, you reported that there was a lot of testimony centered around the bills that would make changes to the bail system. Was there a common thread there in terms of the kinds of testimony lawmakers heard?
Yeah, so I'd say the bills that had the most testimony were the 2 bills surrounding bail. So there's one that would, you know, restrict nonprofit bail organizations like the project, like I mentioned, and the other one would make it a bit harder for people that were arrested for violent crimes to pay their bail. So their bail would be set higher, and they could also, you know, only enlist help from, it would have to be a close relative, like they couldn't have like a friend help them pay their bail. So that was, you know, getting a lot of testimony was surrounding that, and people were saying that that was just really inequitable, and it really, you know, prevents people that just don't have a lot of money and being able to, you know, pay their bail. And then, so I'd say that was the, where a lot of testimony centered around. And then another kind of topic was that some people felt that, you know, having these restrictions around bail was kind of taking discretion away from the courts, and is usually, you know, it's up to judges and lawyers to kind of set those parameters for what bail should look like. And so, you know, kind of taking a little bit of that power away from them, people were saying that was just kind of an infringement on the judicial branch.
And when it comes to the testimony that lawmakers heard, Were these organizations testifying? Were these individuals who were personally affected?
Yeah, so both. So there were some people that they worked for the Bail Project, you know, organizations like that, or there were, you know, community members, you know, who had been in jail themselves and had been in a similar situation. So yeah, I'd say there was a lot of, you know, opposition to those bills, but the FOP, like law enforcement, seemed for the most part in support of them. So there was support, but then there's also opposition as well.
And speaking of opposition, there's been opposition to this package from some Democrats at the State House. What arguments have you heard from them?
Yeah, so the committee that this all that this testimony was heard in, it's a majority Republican committee. There's only two senators on the committee that are Democrats. But we heard like a lot of opposition from Senator Greg Taylor of Indianapolis. He really thought the bills were just really inequitable. That was like his main argument, that it's making it harder for people who are low income to pay their bail. The authors of the bills are obviously in support of them, and they kind of said that they think that it, that people that are wealthy aren't committing those crimes. That was something that was said at the hearing, which I think Senator Greg Taylor was, you know, not in agreement with.
Is there some part of this package that lawmakers are most focused on?
I would say, I don't know if like there's a particular area, but the bail, just the conversations around that just really seem to garner a lot of testimony and kind of some friction. I think that there was just a lot of controversy that came out during when people that had their bail had been paid for by the Bail Project went on to, you know, allegedly commit more crimes. That just garnered a lot of, you know, opposition towards that. So I think like the bail issue for sure, for particularly violent arrestees, is something that they seem to be really passionate about.
What's next for this package of bills? Where's it headed now?
Yeah, so the bills passed through the Senate Committee on Corrections and Criminal Law. All those bills went through with a couple amendments. So now it's going to go on to a second reading in the Senate, which I believe is going to happen this afternoon. And then we'll see where it goes from there. And then it will go over to the House.
Well, thank you so much, Katrina, for joining us and giving us some insight into what's going on. And we'll speak with you hopefully again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Katrina Pross is a criminal justice reporter for WFYI. Now we're going to switch over and be joined by Jeannie Lindsay, our education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, to hear more about what's happening on the education side of things. Jeannie, we're going to get into the details of some of the bills in a second, but before that, can you give us a sense for what role education has played in this session so far?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, education is always of great interest to Indiana lawmakers. Anybody who follows session knows that. But this year, there is a lot of interest about the cultural and political and social aspect of schools, especially as tensions have boiled over in some communities around different things regarding diversity and equity, COVID-19. So education is not just, you know, funding and you know, teacher stuff and you know, school systems this year. A lot of it, at least a lot of the attention so far, has been on a lot of those cultural components.
A couple of weeks ago, Senate Republicans said they could no longer consider Senate Bill 167. Can you give us a little bit of information on that, what that was all about?
Yeah, Senate Bill 167 is the critical race theory, not actually critical race theory bill. So this bill talks a lot about parental authority and insight into curriculum and content. It would allow parents to opt out of certain curricular materials while requiring schools to post those online. It would create review committees led by parents. But it also, another part of it that got a lot of attention was, were the sections restricting, placing limitations on how teachers and schools have conversations about things like race, religion, and politics. It would prohibit the inclusion or promotion of certain concepts that supporters have said are divisive and don't have a place in schools. But the bill covers a lot of ground, and there's a lot of nuance in all of that. But that's a basic outline of the bill. And after a lot of hours of testimony in the Senate Education Committee, the first day of committee meetings for the Senate, or for the Education Committee at least, Republicans decided that there was no path forward for the legislation after sitting on it for a little bit, and made that announcement a couple weeks ago, like you said.
What was it, the 8-hour meeting that killed it?
I don't know if it was the length of the meeting, but I'm sure that probably didn't help. It was quite a long time, but there was a lot of opposition to the bill from all kinds of sides. So a really interesting mix of testimony there.
Yeah, and I think didn't this really put Indiana in the spotlight nationally with this type of a bill?
It did. The bill's author, Senator Scott Baldwin, got into some hot water for talking about, you know, teachers being neutral on things like Nazism. And that made national headlines. He walked back those remarks, but people who heard it in the meeting and listened to the exchange that he made those remarks in were certainly not pleased. So I'm not sure if the bill was taken off because of the publicity around it, the content, or a mix of both. But they announced that it's not being considered by their chamber anymore, which is interesting for the fate of House Bill 1134.
Well, there's a bill in the House. I think that's what you're referring to. That's focused on the same thing that the Senate bill was. What's happening with that one?
Right. Yes. House Bill 1134 is the House version of Senate Bill 167. They're not identical, but they are pretty darn close. So that House Bill 1134 made it out of the House Education Committee recently. I think it wasn't last week, maybe the week before. There were some minor changes made to that legislation, but right now it's awaiting second reading, which is when House lawmakers, the entire chamber, will hear amendments proposed by anybody in the chamber, and everybody will vote on them. And that's been on hold since the bill's author, Representative Cook, has been out for personal reasons in recent days. But he's back now, so we're expecting it soon.
How is this House bill different from the Senate bill?
Yeah, so like I said, they're really similar. There were some small changes that were made to the bill before it made it out of committee. Part of the bill, as it was originally introduced, would have required teachers to post things like lesson plans online. The amendments in the House committee took out the lesson plan language. It also said the eight concepts that are included in the bill that people say are divisive. The language of the original legislation said teachers can't include or promote it. Lawmakers took out the inclusion part, so it's just promotion that's not allowed at this point. And then it also made a couple of changes. Representative Cook, probably in a nod to the neutral on Nazism exchange in the Senate, made clear that the amendment that he proposed, you know, would allow teachers to not be neutral on things like Nazism. It's still fuzzy as to how, you know, this would actually play out. There's a lot of miscommunication, misunderstanding, I think, on the intent of the legislation versus what's actually written in the bill. So there are a few minor changes, but like I said, it's waiting further amendments on the House floor. So could be even a different version after that when it goes to the full House for a final passage vote.
If you're listening live and have a question or comment, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Jeannie, what have you heard from people opposing the House bill? I'm going to assume it's the same sentiment that those opposing the Senate bill have.
Right. A lot of the people we heard in the House Ed Committee were some of the same people in the Senate Education Committee. There was quite a bit of crossover there. But the opposition I found was pretty interesting. There were some people who were opposed to the bill because they didn't think it went far enough. They didn't like that the parental curriculum review committees would be overseen by school boards. Some said that school boards are part of the problem they're having in their communities about, you know, transparency and opting in and out and, you know, curriculum, things like that. So some people were saying that, you know, school boards overseeing, you know, the parent curriculum review wasn't good enough. There were some people who wanted ways to punish individual teachers who might violate parameters of the bill through fees or fines. So there was that side of the opposition. And then there was the other side of the opposition who, you know, said that the bill already goes too far. They worry about the workload that it would put on teachers to post all of their curricular materials, and not just posting their materials, but when parents, you know, are opting their kids in and out of certain things, they worry about the workload it would put on teachers to come up with new materials. And then, you know, if a parent who opted out of the original curriculum didn't like the secondary curriculum, opting out again, you know, just kind of snowballing effect. So there's that concern. And then there's the concern about the conversations about race, religion, and politics. I mean, a lot of the testimony in support of it from parents talked about, you know, conversations on race and white privilege that went too far and made their white children feel guilty for things like slavery. But then, you know, you hear parents, organizations representing Black Hoosiers say this legislation was created without their input. There's also a lack of LGBTQ representation in terms of the provisions in the legislation that aim to, you know, protect students' feelings. LGBTQ representation isn't in the bill at all. People are opposed to the bill for, you know, the parental review committees having the authority to decide what everybody's kids could potentially be learning. And then there's also concerns about, you know, the differentiation of communities across the state. If one community holds really strong ideological values that change the curriculum or content in their school, will those students be educated differently than a community with different values who've, you know, handled the curriculum or the standards or the content differently? So a lot of concerns from all kinds of sides so far with this bill. But there are people who are in support of it, and there are people who are in support of the idea behind it as well.
Before we wrap up, we have about 2 minutes left here. You reported also on a bill that would impact charter school funding. What would this bill do?
Yeah, so this has been on the mind of House Education Committee Chair Representative Bob Boehning for quite a while now. This bill would require school districts to share their referendum funding with charter schools. Representative Boehning has talked about, you know, charter school funding not being to the same level as school districts. And, you know, he sees this as a way to enhance equity and, you know, kind of equalize the playing field in terms of types of schools and have more of the money, you know, follow the student, which is what you'll hear lawmakers talk a lot about, you know, Republicans and having, you know, school choice. So this is kind of a next step for school choice funding to kind of align with that. And so this would, the way that this legislation works is that essentially, if a student, you know, if a school district wins referendum funding and they have a student that lives within the attendance boundary, but that student is enrolled in a charter school, that district has to share a portion of that referendum funding with the charter school that that student goes to. So IPS, Indianapolis Public Schools, is sharing some referendum funding with some of the schools in their network, but the district did that voluntarily. This would make it a requirement for every charter school to receive funding for any, you know, student that goes to them that resides within a public school district boundary. So it's quite different and would require every school district with a charter to do that.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of different elements to it that have to be considered.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just the makeup of different communities, how many charter schools they have. I'll be watching it, see how it goes. So we'll see what happens.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jeannie Lindsay, education reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. And thank you to all of our reporters who joined us this afternoon. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, find it anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.